Penguin Random House Audio presents Against the Wind, Edward Kennedy and the Rise of Conservatism, 1976 to 2009, by Neil Gabler. Read for you by Joe Barrett. Once again, as always, to my beloved daughters, Laurel and Tana, and to my equally beloved son-in-law, Braden, and daughter-in-law, Shoshana, all of whom have devoted their lives to serving others. And to my four grandchildren, Sadie, Oren, Kaya, and Theo, who are the joys of my life. No man is more fortunate than I. May all of them live in a gentler, kinder, and more moral world, and may they help make it so. If anyone has material possessions and sees a brother or sister in need but has no pity on them, how can the love of God be in that person? Dear children, let us not love with words or speech, but with actions and in truth. 1 John chapter 3, verses 17 to 18. Author's note. I began researching this biography long ago, and by the time I finished writing, the political winds had shifted yet again, blowing the country into dark, dangerous, uncharted waters. We live now within an immense and profound cruelty, in a resurgence of white supremacy and the vile hatreds of racism and nativism and misogyny and homophobia and Islamophobia, in an anti-intellectual farrago in which large segments of the public display an aversion to indisputable facts and regard hard science as subversive, in a polarization so wide and hostile that Americans cannot even agree on protecting one another from a virus that, as I write, has taken the lives of 1 million citizens, in a bizarre, dizzying derangement that has a large number of self-described patriotic Americans extolling authoritarian dictators as heroes to be lionized and models to be emulated, and in a deep crisis for democracy itself, now surprisingly as fragile as an eggshell, and which virtually the entire rank and file of one of the nation's 2 major political parties now eschews. None of these terrors came out of the blue, and the story I tell in these chapters about the demise of liberalism and of the liberal consensus that had once been the prevailing American ideology, and the rise of conservatism, which, by the 1980s, had displaced liberalism as the dominant ideology, is certainly a predicate for the crisis in which the nation now finds itself, a crisis in which supporters of a former president march triumphantly with swastikas and wear T-shirts emblazoned with anti-black and anti-Semitic slogans and insist an election, and more, a nation, was stolen from them. Ronald Reagan oversaw a moral recalibration. This is something else, a moral extirpation. As Thomas Mann, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a longtime political observer, recently put it, "The Republican Party has undergone a transformation that precludes having a moral sense, honesty, empathy, respect for one's colleagues, wisdom, institutional loyalty, a willingness to put country ahead of party on existential matters, and openness to changing conditions." If this book tells how the foundation was laid for that extirpation, which threatens to move the tectonic plates of the nation's politics yet again, this time from conservatism to reactionary populism, so might it suggest a way back from the political and moral abyss that we face. Edward Kennedy was a deeply flawed man, for which he was reviled. But for all his faults, he was a good man, a caring man, an empathetic man, a man who sought to make this a better world. His were faults of the flesh, not the soul. He is arguably, an argument I have tried to make, the most consequential public servant of the last 50 years, and the one who did more to help his fellow men and women than any other in that period. To the extent we reflect upon him and his times, I hope that perhaps, albeit in some small way, his political life might serve as a model for future public servants and for citizens generally, that it might remind us of our better selves, that it might show us how one individual can provide a ripple of hope in what seems an angry ocean of hopelessness. that it might challenge the ugliness that seems to have overtaken us, and finally, that it might move us to rediscover our virtue and restore our nation's moral purpose when it is under assault. Introduction. A countervailing wind. In that tense school year that ran from the fall of 1974 to the spring of 1975, Boston seethed as federal judge W. Arthur Garrity Jr. tried to enforce a plan to desegregate the city's schools, and scores of white parents resisted the attempt, resisted it angrily, forcefully, resentfully, and even violently, until the seething erupted into explosion. Among the angriest, most forceful, resentful, and even violent of those parents was 43-year-old Elvira Palladino, or Pixie, as she was known. But Palladino was no Pixie. Though small of stature, she was loud, tough, coarse, vulgar, unfiltered, impolitic, and impolite. She once gave a Monsignor, who supported busing, the Sicilian kiss of death, more a hellion than a sprite. Some called her garbage mouth. The daughter of immigrants from the south of Italy, her father had worked in a shoe factory, and she sewed stitches in a clothing factory herself, which was where she met her future husband. Even after she became a civic leader, helping rouse those furious white parents against the establishment, she preferred to think of herself as a mother. She had two school-aged children, and it was her children who had brought her to the forefront of the anti-busing movement that year as the head of the East Boston chapter of Restore Our Alienated Rights, or ROAR, a perfect acronym for an organization that shouted down proponents of busing. Palladino was blunt. She did not want her children bussed out of East Boston, nor did she want black children bussed in. Races shouldn't mingle, she said. She had led a contingent at the anti-busing rally on Boston's City Hall Plaza on September 9, 1974, 3 days before the opening of the schools, and at the beginning of implementation of the desegregation plan, a rally at which Senator Edward Kennedy, who supported the court desegregation order, had foolishly waded into the restive crowd, hoping to calm them, and instead incited them, so that he was forced to retreat and race into the federal office building named for his brother John, under a torrent of vitriol and a hail of missiles, including a raw egg. And Palladino had led another contingent the following spring, as tensions over busing were still thick, this one in front of South Atlantic High School in Quincy, where Ted had made a speech, and where angry protesters, massing outside, deflated the tires of his car, rubbed dog feces onto the car's door handles, and chased him down the street when he exited the building, screaming at him, until he raced into a subway station, leaped through the doors of an incoming train, and survived. A photo of another rally showed Palladino being forcibly carried away by two policemen. All that year, and into the next, at speeches and hearings and meetings, Palladino, sometimes wearing a tam-o'-shanter over her curly black hair, sometimes wearing a Stop Forced Busing t-shirt, showed up to harass Ted Kennedy, harass him for forsaking the white working class of Boston and favoring black people, whom she called pickaninnies and jungle bunnies. First among his tormentors, the political scientist Ronald Formosano, who wrote a book about the Boston busing acrimony, would call Pixie Palladino due to her hostility to Ted Kennedy. Ted agreed, saying that she seemed to pop up wherever he was, shouting at him at the top of her lungs. She came. She never stopped coming. She was even accused of punching him in the stomach during the fracas at the City Hall rally. But Pixie Palladino and her army of angry Italian and Irish mothers, who would drive their cars in motorcades through the Boston streets blasting their horns to protest busing, were not anomalies that year. In fact, they had drawn encouragement from the new president, Gerald Ford, who had ascended to the office after Richard Nixon was driven from it by his Watergate depredations, and who had argued forcefully against court-ordered busing for the purpose of desegregating schools. Far from anomalies, these women had become the face of America, ordinary folks, salt of the earth, a no longer silent majority, tired of being taken for granted, taking to the barricades, and their hostility toward Ted Kennedy, who had once been their champion and hero, was a sign of how dramatically the country had changed.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?